If you want access to bonus episodes, reading lists for every series of Empire, a chat community, discounts for all the books mentioned in the week's podcast, ad-free listening, and a weekly newsletter, sign up to Empire Club at www.empirepoduk.com.
Hello and welcome to Empire with me, Anita Arnon.
And me, William Durrenpool.
I'm very excited about today because we are joined by the great Hugh Kennedy, author of so many books on the Islamic Caliphate, including The Court of the Caliphs, The Rise and Fall of Islam's Greatest Dynasty. And we just heard from William just while we were sort of rigging up. You have an entire Kennedy corner of books, is that right?
I have a shelf, not a corner, a shelf, an entire groaning shelf of the collected works of Hugh Kennedy on Umayyads, Abbasids, Caliphates, early Islamic eras. I've been trying to get Hugh to come to various festivals and give various lectures for years, and we finally cornered him here at the pod, which is a very exciting moment.
He's a bit of a fanboy, Hugh, so, you know, control yourself, Darren Paul. But look, we've got Hugh on to discuss another great empress. So we have, as you may have known if you've been following us, and if you haven't, where have you been? We've missed you. Cleopatra, Saint Helena, the discoverer of the one true cross, Theodora, who rules the Roman Empire. We are talking, Hugh, about somebody now who is as significant, you think, in history, Al-Khizaran. Can you tell us why we should care about her and why she was important? And did I say it right? That would help.
She is Khizaran, yes. And she was in the end, the wife and, if you like, queen, or at least consort, of the third of the Abbasid caliphs, Muhammad al-Mahdi. We'll just call him al-Mahdi to keep it simple now. And so, as a woman, she was the partner of the most powerful man in Western Eurasia, certainly, and certainly the most powerful person in the Islamic world. So, by that very connection, she just is an important and significant figure. But she's also important and significant because of her life and what her life and her progress of her life from the most obscure origins up to being this really important figure in the whole politics of the Middle East. The whole story of her life is interesting.
Hugh, give us a picture of the Abbasid Empire.
We're talking about the 700s. I mean, we should say what we're anchor this in dates.
We start off, of course, with the death of Prophet Muhammad in 632. And that leads almost immediately after his death, you get this great expansion of Arab armies, which by the year 700 have come to rule the whole area from Central Asia and Sindh in modern Pakistan, right through to the Atlantic coast of Morocco and right through to Spain. It's an enormous land empire. And it's ruled at first by a dynasty called the Umayyads, who in the year 750 were replaced in a revolution by a rival dynasty called the Abbasids. And the Abbasids were called Abbasids because they were the direct descendants of Prophet Muhammad's uncle, Al-Abbas. And so they took their name from him. And that gave them a certain sort of status because while not being descendants of the Prophet, they were actually part of the wider family of the Prophet. And that gave them a religious cachet, if you like, that the Umayyads had lacked.
And Hugh, this is the period described in the Arabian Nights. Baghdad, the city which is the capital of the Abbasids, is the setting for these fabulous stories.
Yes. Baghdad was the creation of the second Abbasid caliph, al-Mahdi's father, a man called al-Mansur, who founded it as a new town in 762. And it expanded enormously. Immigrants came from all over the Middle East. The core of them were the army and the bureaucrats who were paid by the states. But lots of people came from every direction to offer goods and services and to be craftsmen and merchants and everything. So, certainly by the year 800, shortly after Khizaran's death, we reckon that the population of Baghdad was about 500,000. It might have been more, it might have been less. So smaller than Rome in the height of its population, but a very significant city, more populous than Constantinople.
There's a wonderful Chinese visitor at this point. He turns up and writes, he says, everything produced from the earth is here. Carts carry countless goods to market, where everything is available and cheap. Brocade, embroidered silk, pearls, and other gems are displayed all over the markets, the streets, and the shops. But it's also a major intellectual center, isn't it, Hugh? It's a place where you get the learning of ancient India, the learning of ancient Persia, the learning of the Arab world and the Byzantine world all coming together. And you get this atmosphere of terrific intellectual excitement. From the salons of Baghdad, you get the elite hungrily absorbing all these different ideas, diverse ideas from East and West, all the ancient civilizations, Greek, Egyptian, Babylonian, Persian, and Chinese, all this, these entire intellectual traditions are coming together in Baghdad for the first time.
Yes, because it was such a big city, there was a market for, if you like, intellectual products. There was a market for books. We know that there was a street of booksellers, a souk of booksellers, that had 100 different separate shops in the 9th century, where you could go and browse through the manuscripts and read away to your heart's content.
In comparison to which, in the whole of Western Europe, probably, there are, what, you know, a handful of monasteries with decent libraries. Nothing at all to compare with this.
And of course, this is helped by the new technology of paper. As paper comes in, probably from China originally, certainly from the East, and paper democratizes writing. It means that writing is much cheaper because the basic materials are much cheaper. And that encourages the copying and selling of books on a large scale in a way which is impossible if you just use parchment or something like that, which are the older supports of writing. So it's this new technology that helps the intellectual atmosphere in Baghdad. But as you rightly say, it's people coming from all over the world. A lot of Iranian influence. One of the things the Abbasids did was shift the capital from Damascus in Syria to their new town of Baghdad in Iraq. And this opens the floodgates, if you like, for Iranian influence on political style, Iranian influence on
architecture,
intellectual achievements, and the introduction of Arabic numerals and so on, but also a keen interest in ancient Greek intellectual life. And despite the fact that the Greeks, and or the Byzantines, as we'd like to call them, and the Abbasids were enemies along the frontier, in fact, the Abbasid elite was keenly interested in ancient Greek intellectual life.
There's one wonderful story you tell in one of your books about a truce with the Byzantines, and the price of the truce is some of the Greek classic, is it Aristotle or Plato or one of the, they won't grant a truce unless they send some of these scientific books from the libraries in Constantinople.
That's it. But they were interested in science. They were interested in mathematics. They were interested in medicine. They were interested in astronomy and everything like that. They didn't read any of the books we read from the Greek tradition. They didn't translate history, they didn't translate poetry, they didn't translate plays or anything like that, but they wanted the STEM subject, so to speak, the hard science of what they were after.
They sound like my husband. Now, I'm in very, very keen to bring in our woman, Al-Khaizarun. Tell us, what do we actually know for sure about where she was born and the circumstances of her birth? Because Baghdad wasn't her origin story, was it?
No. Her origins are pretty obscure. And some of the stories about her youth are certainly made up by either her friends or her enemies at a later date. She was almost certainly of Arab stock, but she seems to have been captured as a young girl in one of the sort of raids between Arab tribes, and it was effectively a slave. And she was brought from probably South Arabia, where she lived, to Mecca. And Mecca and Medina were the great cultural centers in the early Islamic period. The slave girls of Medina were the best taught singers. And if you really wanted to get talented young women to come work for you, then Mecca and Medina is where you went to find them.
Jawari, is that the phrase? Jaria?
Yes, the institution of the Jaria. The Jaria was a female, a young woman who was renowned in popular literature and so on for her musical abilities, for her beauty, of course, because all young women in all these stories are always beautiful, and her sexual availability, but also her talents. And we know, for example, that Khizr Rahn, besides having all the poetry and so on at her fingertips, was also the sort of person who could commentate learnedly on Quran and on the Hadith of Prophet Muhammad and so on. So it wasn't all completely frivolous stuff. And it was the ideal of the rounded Jariya who could both sing and introduce all sorts of learned discourse, but also remembered the old songs, remembered the poetry that was the ultimate achievement of Abbasid culture. The great poets were famous, they were rich.
They were, in effect, the rock stars of their day, I guess you could say.
Exactly, exactly. And like rock stars, they were allowed to behave badly.
Oh, good. Good, good. Really interesting. I mean, you say we don't know much about her. I mean, I was doing a search for imagery of her. There's not much at all, sort of visuals of what she looked like. And how do you explain that?
It's not a visual culture. This makes it very different from the Greek, somebody like Theodora that you've been discussing and so on. This isn't a culture that records images of people, and particularly of women. It would have been considered indelicate or even outrageous to attempt a portrait of a woman like her.
Hugh, in early Umayyad culture, you do get images of women and of dancing girls and all sorts of things in the bathhouses of the Umayyads and so on, and in those wonderful desert palaces. But the Abbasids, almost nothing. It disappears.
Now, this may be simply that we've lost a whole culture, but even in the case of the Umayyad ones, the images are generic. They're not of a particularly named individual. That would make the difference and accounts for it. So her name, Khizr Rahn, means a reed. So we assume that she was slender and delicate and so on in appearance. But nobody would comment on that because, as I say, it's a private matter.
And it's a nickname rather than an actual name? I mean, Al-Khizr Rahn is a stage name? Or
I think it was her name she was given when she was being trained up to make her attractive and interesting and to prospective buyers, basically.
Right. I mean, when you say attractive and interesting, it's kind of courtesan level attractive and interesting, or attractive and interesting with sort of marriage prospects?
Certainly at a courtesan level.
Right.
And we know that she was brought to Mecca. She was trained up in all the skills that these women were supposed to have. She was sold to the Caliph al-Mansur when he came on pilgrimage. She came on the Hajj to Mecca. And she was given by al-Mansur to his son al-Mahdi. And that's her route to success.
Can I just pause for a ew? I know this happens, but ew. Just sort of, you know, women being passed on as commodity, it always makes me feel a bit ew. Let me ask you this. I mean, there are often parallels drawn between her and Scheherazade of 1001 Nights, you know, sort of suggesting that she was this bright, clever, beautiful creature. I mean, how much of that, and why has that happened? Because I often see the two conflated.
They can be conflated, but Scheherazade, we are told in the frame story, was the daughter of the vizier. Scheherazade comes from upper class background, at least in the stories that we have about her. Khizr Rahn doesn't. And Khizr Rahn's whole career shows that being a slave gave you opportunities of social mobility that ordinary, as it were, Muslims digging in the fields didn't have, because it brought you into close proximity with power. And the fact that you were given to the caliph means that she had an opportunity to shine and display her talents.
It's so counterintuitive to think of it that way. I do want to know, though, what we know. She's passed from father to son as a gift. So she would have lived in the harem at that point. What was life like for women in the harem?
It's very difficult to tell. Most of what we know about, or we think we know about harems, are necessarily fantasy. We don't have any memoirs of anybody who was brought up in a harem at this stage. A harem simply means the women's quarters. We know that in palaces, that the women lived in different parts of the palace, as they did in Byzantine court at the same time. There was a women's domain, as it were. And within that, there was a good deal of freedom, I think, for women to live their own lives, as it were. And a very important thing is that women were allowed their own property and kept and managed their own property. Of course, lots of women didn't have any property. They were poor and so on. But somebody like Khizr Rahn or the other queens we know of from the Abbasid period, some of them were immensely rich. Khizr Rahn certainly died a very rich woman. And she kept her own household. She had her own stewards and business managers. And this is mostly recorded in terms of her charity, giving of good causes. She was one of the people, along with her successor, Zubaydah, who was Harun al-Rashid's wife, who set in motion the building of a long roadway, really, called the Darb Zubaydah nowadays, the Path of Zubaydah, but Khayzuran started it, so that pilgrims could pass from Iraq across the Arabian desert, even at the height of summer, to the holy cities, to the Haramain of Mecca and Medina. And this was the biggest civil engineering project in 8th century Western Eurasia and probably in the entire world. It involved enormous setting up of cisterns, fortresses, clearing the road of stones and all this sort of thing. And it was, above all, women's pious generosity that created this network. So there's a lot of disposable income. There's a lot of control over what they did with their income. But of course, these were the lucky 1%.
Hugh, we know not only Al-Khayzuran herself as a powerful figure, we also know Zubaydah, her successor. And now, is this a newly developed power that Abbasid queens have, or do you see it earlier in the Umayyad period too?
It seems to be something that's coming in the Abbasid period. I think we know the names of the partners of the Umayyad caliphs, who were almost all Arabs of high standing, but we don't get the same sort of stories about them that we do about Khayzuran and Zubaydah. And these are the two most important queens. Interestingly, in the next century, that changes. Caliphs stop marrying. All the caliphs are sons of slaves who, in many cases, remain slaves. But the key figure in the women's court in the next century is the queen mother. And it's the queen mother who rules the harem. Whereas in time of Khayzuran and Zubaydah, it's the partner, the favorite partner of the caliph.
Right. Well, let's talk about being the favorite partner, because being the favorite partner of al-Mahdi, she also has his favorite children, it turns out. I mean, I suppose those two things go hand in hand. But she has two sons and a daughter. And I'm really interested in the daughter, because
Banuka.
It seems as if the caliph is so enamored with how lovely his little daughter is and how great she is, that he wants to hang out with her quite a lot. So dresses her as a boy so he can hang out with her. I mean, that's right, isn't it?
Yes, exactly so. Yes. But within the family, there wouldn't have been a problem about it. But yes, she's dressed as a boy. And people say, they look at her and say, that's a girl riding by, you know, dressed as a boy. And al-Mahdi is one of the more attractive characters amongst the Abbasid caliphs in many ways. I mean, he was a pious man, and he obviously had very close relations with women, not just on a partnership basis, and so to speak, not just with Khayzuran, but with his cousin Raita and so on. So it does emerge, and he's famous for his generosity and so on. He's famous for his piety. He was one of the few Abbasid caliphs who didn't drink wine on a regular basis, and he was encouraged things like pilgrimage to Mecca.
Okay, but she's still, I mean, even though she has, you know, produced the favored children, and she is clearly a favorite of al-Mahdi, she's still a slave. At what point does she become a wife rather than a slave?
The year is often given 775, when she is freed because she produces a male son. Slave girls who produced male offspring were usually given their freedom, and they stopped being slaves. So you get a lot of one-generation slavery.
Is that as a reward, or is that in order to raise the status of the son?
Both, I think. So we get this one-generation slavery, that girls who are favored by their masters achieve their freedom. And most unusually, of course, al-Mahdi actually marries her, rather than just keeping her as part of the household, and she becomes his wife. And certainly in the Umayyad period, the idea of a slave girl becoming the wife of a caliph would not have been doable. That didn't stop caliphs sleeping with slave girls, but they're becoming an official wife. And Khayzuran, like Zubaydah after her, achieved that status.
So what should we assume about Al-Khayzuran because of the fact that she was freed and then married? What does that imply? That it's a love affair? That she's remarkable? That she's socially acceptable? What are the different things we can read into that?
Yes, I think insofar as we can gauge these things, of course, it is a love affair, or at least it's a very companionate relationship. And it must be something to do with her sexual attractiveness, must be one of the factors that's involved with this. But she obviously is shrewd and clever. I think we always think of the caliphs as being almighty people who do whatever they like and don't care about anything. But being a caliph must be a very lonely business. You're always surrounded by people who want something from you and who are making demands on you and sometimes are plotting against you. So if, as a caliph, you find a partner like Mahdi obviously found with Qaisuran, who was loyal and shrewd and clever and stood up and was with him, then that, I think, was probably more of an attraction than anything else. Just the supportive relationship must have been immensely valuable.
Do we have any idea about her original status before she was enslaved? You say she was captured in a tribal fight. Do we know whether her family were from the top of the pyramid or the bottom?
Well, this is an interesting question, because when she was originally trained as a slave girl and originally met Mansour and so on, one of the attractions was that she claimed she had no family. And of course, this was very important, because if you marry the caliph and you've got a family, then the family are going to expect a lot of favors, prominent positions in the government. They are going to feel that they are owed something, and they're going to become a faction, basically, in the politics. So Qaisuran, shrewd woman that she was, claims that she has no family. And then she gets her status, she's freed and she's married, and she says, oh, by the way, I do have a brother.
Ta-da!
I actually do.
I do have a brother and a number of cousins.
Oh, I like her.
And they happen to be on their way to Baghdad now as we speak.
Yeah, exactly.
See that? What a coinkidink. What
perhaps
a coinkidink.
We could do something for them.
Hilarious.
And that what happens, a newly discovered brother becomes an important person in politics.
He becomes the governor of Yemen, doesn't he? Yeah, he actually rises to a very senior position.
So we think that she probably came from Yemen. There's no evidence that she came from, that these were a very important family before this moment.
Around the time of 775, something monumental happens, which really accelerates that, or I suppose magnifies that position of power and makes it even more important.
Yes, well, Al-Mahdi becomes caliph. He succeeds his father, the rather grim, severe, but immensely able Al-Mansur. And he's a breath of fresh air in the court and so on.
She's quite a mover and shaker, though, because not only does she manage to suddenly, ta-da, produce a family that she said she didn't have, but she manages in this whirlpool of different wives and different children to make her children rise up to the point where it is her son who becomes the crown prince. And when does that happen, and how does that happen?
It certainly happens after her marriage. But the intriguing thing is that we really don't know how it happens, because Reta had two sons as well. And why they weren't selected, we simply don't know. And it may be that they were sickly children who didn't thrive and so on. So and all sorts of reasons that we really can't know about. Or it may be because Qaisuran was very effective and said, look, I've got these two young lads and they're definitely going to be the heirs. And Al-Mahdi accepts that. It's a very important decision, but we've no idea how it was made. They just do emerge as the heir. The first heir and the second heir, so to speak. And her eldest son, who is called Musa al-Hadi, we'll call him al-Hadi, but he's Musa, which is Moses al-Hadi, is the first heir and is the eldest. Now, he comes across in the sources as a very macho young man. He has very close relations with the military. He loves going on campaign. He loves doing hunting and all these things. He's quite headstrong.
He leads a campaign against the Byzantines quite early on after his succession.
Yes, against the Byzantines, but also in northern Iran and so on. So he has the military contacts. He is the favorite of the army, shall we say. And the younger son, Harun, is portrayed as a very different sort of young man. His close contacts are with the court officials.
It's a good point to take a break, because now we've got a woman who has, and this is a familiar template for many of the women we've done in this series, who's risen from nothing, who has been passed around as chattel, who has risen through the ranks and managed to get herself to the very top of the court. And not only herself, but her children as well. So we've got crown princes, we've got the caliph's ear. This is a source of enormous power. Let's take a break and find out after the break what she does with it. Welcome back. So just before the break, we were talking about this girl from a lowly background who has risen to the heights. She now has the caliph's ear. She is a favorite. Her children are favorites. But something happens in around, we think, 785, where This is now a stratospheric rise to power. Tell us about that.
So can I do a reading here? Because I've got here the wonderful chronicle of the amazing Abbasid historian Masudi. It's called The Meadows of Gold. Now, Masudi gives a very full account, the best account we have, of the fallout between the young Caliph Hadi and his mother Al-Khizrun. And we are presented with this picture of a young Caliph who's threatened by the popularity, the industry, and the sheer power of his mother. And I think the best I could do is probably just read it. Hadi was extremely deferential towards his mother, Khizrun, and gave her everything she asked for her proteges. Innumerable queues of petitioners stood before the gates, which led one courtier to say, "Gently now, Khizrun, stop and let your sons govern their subjects." One day, however, she asked him for a favor, which was impossible to grant. And as he was searching for excuses, she cried, "You absolutely must agree." "I cannot," said Hadi. His mother then retorted, "But I have guaranteed Abd al-Allah ibn Malik that you would do this for him." These words angered the Caliph. "Curse that son of a whore," he said. "I knew that request came from him. By God, I'm not going to grant it to you." "God knows then," said Khizrun, "that I shall never ask you for anything again." "God knows," replied Hadi, "that I shan't be sorry for that." He flew into a rage, and his mother, no less angry, rose to leave. "Stay," he said to her, "and hear what I have to say. If I break the oath that follows, let me deny my descent from the Prophet. May the prayers and peace of God be upon him. If any one of my generals, or my court, or my servants, goes to ask you for favors, he will have his head cut off and his goods confiscated. Let he who wants to see it try it. What are all these crowds that besiege your gates every day from early morning? Have you no spindle to amuse you? No Quran for your prayers? No room in which you can stay? Take care, and may God help you if you open your mouth to plead for anyone, Muslim or tributary." Khizrun arose, unable to believe her ears and scarcely knowing where she was going. From that day, she no longer said a word to her son, sweet or bitter. So after this fallout, his mother very much pushed the cause of her second son, Harun al-Rashid, who had the support of the Barmakids, who were this key family who had made Baghdad, who had come from Central Asia, who were masters of mathematics, who had grown up in the Sanskritic Buddhist tradition, which their family was originally from, and understood Indian mathematics and brought it to Baghdad, which is why today we all use Indian numbers, though we call them Arabic numbers.
Yes, the Barmakids are very important, and they're in charge of the civil administration, the writing offices, and above all, they're in charge of the collection of the taxes. And that gives them a real power.
Useful chaps to have on your back.
Exactly, because the army needs to be paid by taxes, and it's the Barmakids who control that. So you can see very easily how these two factions are brought into conflict or brought into rivalry. And Harun means Aaron, incidentally. So we've got Moses, the first brother, Musa, and Harun, Aaron, and we know the relationship between Moses and Aaron is paralleled by this. But Harun is his mother's favorite, and this had fatal consequences for al-Hadi, because al-Hadi becomes caliph. He's only caliph for about a year.
And he tries to keep his mum in the kitchen, doesn't he? He tries to stop her interfering in politics, yeah.
Exactly. She's told to behave herself and go back to her spinning wheel and things like that.
So there is a story, and tell me, Hugh, if this is true or not and where this comes from, whether Musa is such a chauvinist piglet, because he's the son, that he turns around to his mother and says, "It is not in the power of women to intervene in matters of sovereignty. Look at your prayers and your prayer beads," which sounds a lot to me like, "Get thee to a kitchen, lady."
Oh, yes, this story is precisely making that point, whether these are the words that were spoken or not. We can't be certain.
Well, where does it come from?
It comes from Tabari's History of the Prophets and Kings, which is the great, enormous, wonderful history of the early Islamic world.
That's wonderfully gossipy and full of details like this that may or may not be true, but which paint a wonderfully vivid picture of the intrigues of the court.
Yes, they may not be true, but they have meaning, if you see what I mean. They reflect not necessarily the actual words, but they reflect attitudes and so on. That's how these historians present the work. Rather than making a general argument, as modern historians would, they seize on a person and put words into usually his mouth, sometimes her mouth. And that's the way you present an argument. That's the way you build up a picture.
There's a suggestion that he's even more of a little shit than just being a sexist pig, that he actually tries to poison his mother. He sort of so wants to curtail his mother's movement that he sends her a delicious dish of something that is poisoned. And she, instead of eating it, gives a little bit to her doggy, a little doggy to try, and the dog keels over and dies, just like Clarissa. So she's saved from that. Where does that come from?
From the same imagination that produces the stories of the Arabian Nights.
really?
Because the world of the intimate household of the caliphs is so private, then any number of stories can be made up. Now, that doesn't mean that it isn't true, but we've got no reason to assume that it is either. Something like this, Al-Hadi dies dramatically and suddenly.
So, of course, we don't really know what happened to Hadi. But he, according to one account, he falls gravely ill, perhaps with a stomach ulcer, which was a malady to which the family, over many generations, seems to have been susceptible. But it seems more likely that he'd consumed a poison his mother had managed to mix with his drink. And the suggestion in some of the chronicles, not Masudi, but other versions, has Al-Khizrun actually poisoned her son Hadi in revenge for excluding her from the business of the empire. And no sooner had Hadi been killed or expired than the Barmakids rally and they find Harun al-Rashid, who's out wandering around the Euphrates Valley, and they wake him up. He's naked in bed, is the story we're told. And Yahya Barmakid, who's the guy who is his old tutor and his old teacher, says, "Awake, O commander of the believers." "What are you saying?" cried Harun. "Don't you know that what will become of me if Hadi learns that I've been so addressed?" But on hearing that his brother was dead, Harun lost no time in setting out to take possession of the seals of state. As he left, he received another message, one announcing the birth of a son to his Persian concubine, Marajil. The boy who had been named Abdullah became the Caliph Mamnun in time. Thus, on one night of destiny, predicted by Khizrun, says the chronicler, saw the death of one caliph, the accession of a second, and the birth of a third.
Can we also say, whereas, Al-Hind is the one who says, "Get into the kitchen, mother," that Harun al-Rashid is more of a mummy's boy. I mean, is that true to say?
That's what the sources tell us, and it may well be true.
No need to argue with them, exactly.
There's a small group of people who knew each other very well, and so, that seems to be the implication.
So you gave us the nod about the Arabian Nights and the imaginative world that enters in. Now, the Arabian Nights centers very heavily on the young Harun in disguise, visiting the fleshpots of Baghdad in the streets, in the company with the youngest generation of the Barmakids, this guy called Jafar. And those of us who watched our kids looking at Aladdin
know
Jafar as that very sort of handsome Indian-looking guy with a high collar, and he's the bad boy.
And he has a parrot who's also a bad parrot. He's a bad parrot. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about these two young men, certainly as portrayed in the Arabian Nights, Hugh.
The Arabian Nights reflects what the historians are telling us, that Harun al-Rashid and Jafar the Barmakid, who is the Barmakid who is of his generation, or one of them anyway, were very close friends.
And more than that, they shared wet nurses, don't they?
Yes.
The Barmakid boys are nursed by the Abbasid women, and the Abbasid boys are nursed by the Barmakid women. So you swap babies. It's the most intimate thing you can do in this world.
Yes. So, they make them virtually family.
And so these two young men are running loose, creating havoc in the streets, in disguise, pretending to be ordinary boys in the streets, when in fact they're from these two super rich, super powerful families.
Yes, yes. Whether they really create havoc or not, it's more difficult to tell. But they certainly have adventures, and it's a way the storytellers use of opening doors into other people's lives and so on. And then, they go there and they find whoever it is who tells them a story about how he was once in India, and, the whole thing goes on and on from there. But there are three of them. One is Harun, the other is Jafar, who is a young man of his own age and doesn't seem to have any of the sinister reputation that comes in later night stories that you're talking about. And the third is Masrur, who is both the servant, factotum, and executioner. And there's these three go around to, and have these adventures.
He's sort of Jeeves, but with an assassin's dagger.
Yeah.
One of the things that young Jafar and young Harun do together is play chess, isn't it? They're one of the very first chess players we know about in history.
Yes.
And chess is introduced from the Indian world by the Barmakids again.
By that sort of coming in of Persian influences and so on. You're absolutely right. Chess seems to come from India, it comes through Iran, and then it becomes something that the elite do. They also play nard, they play backgammon, and I don't know what the history of backgammon is, but that's very much around at the time.
Can I just bring us back to the Queen Mother, though? Sort of now the floor is cleared for her son to rule, the one that she likes more, who doesn't want to remove her from the scene. Do we know how her stature grows and how much her influence remains in the kingdom? What do we know of what happens to her in all of this?
Well, we know that Khatoran flourished under the rule of her son Harun. We know that he paid enormous and public respect to her at the time of her funeral, which was unusual, perhaps.
Well, we haven't killed her off yet. What year is this that she dies, and how does she die?
She dies just 3 years after her son Harun accedes to the throne. So she only has 3 years, as it were, in power until 789. She dies, apparently of natural causes. I mean, there's no reason to assume anything else. So she's achieved all she wants to achieve, but she doesn't get much time to enjoy it. And during those 3 years, it seems that she and her Barmakid allies and one or two people in the military are running the state for this young and inexperienced youth.
So how young is he?
He's in his 20s. Almost all these people, almost all the caliphs died very young. Only one Abbasid caliph, out of 28 or something, reached the age of 60. And Harun al-Rashid, okay. Who's, you know, Harun al-Rashid, you see these portraits of him with a long beard, a gracious old grey-bearded ancient, died at the age of 43. I mean, they were all quite young men.
Yeah, but back to his mother. When you say she was running the state, I mean, what does that mean in essence? What does that look like?
Well, this really happened in the next century, but the Abbasid women became very influential through their sons and advising their sons, but also because they were very wealthy. And in the next century, when the caliphate was in financial crisis, caliphs could and did appeal to their mothers to try and bail out the government, which is a testimony to the enormous wealth that some of these women had. And of course, because they were very wealthy, everyone wanted to come and see them. Everyone wanted to do business with them and so on. And if you want the caliph to do something, then you try in one way or another to approach him through his mother.
Do we know any of the acts of patronage of Al-Khaizarun? Any great buildings in Baghdad associated with her? Any of the great mosques? Like in later years, you get Ottoman and Mughal women and Safavid women.
No, sadly not. And the reason for this is because Abbasid Baghdad lives on in our imagination. It lives on in literary descriptions. It lives on in the Arabian Nights. But the fabric of the city has completely disappeared. There is no standing monument because it was mud brick and it dissolves in the rain, and because it's beside the Tigris, and the Tigris is a fickle friend. It provides lots of water, but it changes its course. And the great round city that Al-Mansur built finds itself in the middle of the riverbed at one stage, and it's simply washed away by repeated floods. So we don't have a single thing that we can touch and see that belongs to Abbasid Baghdad. And yet we have this huge wealth of historical literature, geographical literature, imaginative literature, poems about the city and so on.
Hugh, just finally, I sort of leapt in when you were starting to talk about the funeral, but the funeral is a very good story. So this exemplifies how important she was to the caliph. What does he do when his mother dies? How does he show his grief to the people and the importance of her?
Muslim funerals happen very quickly, day of, preferably. The funeral is just a gathering together of those people around. What's striking is that Harun attends the funeral as one of the leading mourners, and it would be most unusual for the caliph to attend a funeral publicly. And it would be most unusual for a caliph to honour a woman in that sort of way. And in fact, for a long time after Khaizaran's death, the government that she had put together, if you like, continued to run the state effectively in their own interests and the interests of the administration and so on and so forth. So they are, in a sense, the government of Harun is made in her image. The coalition she put together continues.
Hugh, one of the legacies that one could perhaps trace to Al-Khaizarun is that while she dies, the institution of the queen remains central And the next phase of the story of the Abbasids is dominated by Zubaydah, who is the wife of Harun al-Rashid. And it's Zubaydah that brings down the Barmakids in a kind of scene that resembles The Godfather, isn't it? In one night, all six of the Barmakid palaces are raided, heads are put on stakes, they're thrown into prison, all this sort of thing.
Yes, Zubaydah isn't certainly the only actor in this.
She ends up with a lot of their wealth, though, doesn't she? She certainly, whether or not she's brought about this Godfather Knight of Knives, a lot of their palaces end up in her personal disposal.
People at the time speculated about what happened to the Barmakids. Basically, nobody knew why Harun turned against them so dramatically.
Suddenly turns on them.
Exactly as you say, it's all over in the night, and his bosom friend Jaffa, his body parts are displayed on the bridges in Baghdad for the populace to gawp at. And having been 2 days before the powerful and cherished companion of the Caliph. And it goes down through Islamic history as the archetype of pride comes before a fall, if you like, of how even the most powerful people can be completely destroyed and reduced to nothing by the will of the ruler.
So if we look back at Al-Khaizarun, Hugh, do we remember her as one of the most powerful women in early Islamic history? The most powerful woman in early Islamic history?
She's certainly one of the most powerful women. I mean, just in her influence on politics and her wealth, we can certainly say that. And the whole story of her life is an illustration of how talent and imagination can get you right up the social scale in this society. And it's a society where social mobility for the lucky few is very much a reality. So yes, she is definitely one of the most powerful.
It's a really interesting story. Thank you so much for sharing it with us, Hugh Kennedy. It's been a pleasure. That's it from this episode of Empire. Goodbye from me, Anita Arnon.
And goodbye from me, William Durrampool.